I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
American helicopter gunships have been firing on a poor neighborhood of Baghdad today, the second day of fighting since a prominent Shiite cleric called on his followers to terrorize your enemy. Muqtada al-Sadr heads the Mahdi Army, a militia of several thousand fighters. Paul Bremer, the head of the U.S.-led authority in Iraq, branded al-Sadr an outlaw and said that his tactics will not be tolerated. And today, U.S. authorities announced that an Iraqi judge has issued an arrest warrant for al-Sadr for the murder of a rival cleric earlier this year. At least 52 Iraqis and 9 coalition troops died in violence, which spread to several cities yesterday. Meanwhile, U.S. forces have surrounded the mainly Sunni Muslim city of Fallujah ahead of expected large-scale raids to round up suspected militants there. For more, we're joined from Baghdad by Boston Globe staff reporter Ann Barnard. Ann, welcome.
Thanks a lot.
Ann, what's the situation on the streets today?
Well, this morning, people in Sadr City were angry and concerned about injuries. There are 15 or 20 bodies seen on the streets by reporters who went there. This afternoon, it seems to be much calmer there. U.S. troops seem to be in control, although my Iraqi colleague who went there talked to a man who said he was a member of the Mahdi Army and said, just wait till nightfall, we're going to attack again. It was a scale of fighting that Baghdad hasn't seen since April, with helicopter gunships firing on a neighborhood. And the resistance they put up last night was pretty serious. They were able to pin down a U.S. patrol, and then when reinforcements came, two separate columns of Bradley fighting vehicles were also ambushed. And the situation was not calmed until about 1,000 U.S. troops were in the area, including a column of tanks.
Now, Paul Bremer, the U.S. administrator, has called al-Sadr an outlaw and has vowed some kind of a response. What are people in Baghdad expecting that response would be?
Well, the response is obviously already ongoing. They have arrested 5 of Sadr's deputies. They're now issuing the warrant for his arrest. They clearly were going after members of Sadr's organization in al-Shuwaila. And the question is whether the resistance to those actions is going to spread throughout Baghdad. That's what people are afraid of.
How concerned are U.S. military commanders about all this?
They are confident that they'll be able to handle it, but they also said candidly that they really don't. One of the commanders was asked, is this a situation where ordinary Baghdad residents should be afraid? And he said, it's really too soon to tell.
Given that Muqtada al-Sadr is surrounded by thousands of his militia vowing to die rather than let him be taken, what can U.S. commanders do?
Well, they're in a very difficult position because, as the commander said today, how you respond to this depends on whether you view it as a military engagement with a gang of armed thugs or a popular uprising. And if it remains a narrow military engagement, then they obviously will go after their military foe as aggressively as possible. If they get into a situation where you have ordinary people rising up and teenagers and people that would in normal life be civilians, then they don't want to get into a situation where they are killing scores of people and just bringing more popular anger on themselves. So they're facing a very tough choice right now. They obviously are going to react strongly, but they're very aware that they have to keep an eye on the situation and see how much support Sadr is getting from other quarters.
And on another front, what's the latest from Fallujah, which is now encircled by U.S. Marines, vowing revenge for those killings of U.S. civilians last week?
The U.S. Marines have sealed off the entrances to Fallujah. A resident that we spoke to on the phone reported overnight that several houses were attacked by U.S. forces. People were detained and some people were killed. People were ordered to stay in their homes and not to go out in the streets and were warned that the operation might take several days. The voices out of Fallujah have been very defiant, saying we will fight the Americans to the death. At the same time, the U.S. says this is not going to be a random house-to-house search of the kind that have upset people in the past. They said we have specific targets that we're going after. The question is whether they really have intelligence or reliable intelligence on who was involved in the attacks last week. It's really been difficult in Fallujah to get anyone to inform on the insurgency.
Ann Barnard, Boston Globe reporter in Baghdad. Ann, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
Federal investigators are looking into the nonprofit organization overseeing the reopening of the Statue of Liberty, following reports that the statue could have opened earlier than its proposed July date, but for a fundraising campaign that critics say was unnecessary. Joining us on the line is Mike McIntyre of the New York Times. And Mike, we know the statue was closed following the September 11th attacks, and this fundraising campaign involves Americans donating money from Folgers coffee lids and their American Express charges. Mayor Bloomberg donated $100,000 of his own money.
Yes, it's not uncommon for the Statue of Liberty Ellis Island Foundation over the years to launch fundraising campaigns that have a corporate sponsorship element to them, where they do enlist corporations who contribute a large amount of money themselves and then also solicit contributions from consumers.
But what's wrong with that? What's the criticism?
Well, I think that in this case, the criticism by members of Congress and others is that, you know, number one, the Park Service wavered for quite a long time on whether they even wanted to reopen the statue. And then, two, when they finally made a decision to do that, rather than seek federal funding for it, which a number of members of Congress say would easily have been available, they instead turned it over to the foundation, which had ample assets from which to pay for this work, yet instead chose to launch a fundraising campaign.
Is the criticism that it was a fundraising campaign through companies like Folgers and Walmart, which, you know, is sort of advertising for those companies, or that it involved Americans giving of their own money? Because I'm thinking many Americans wouldn't mind that.
Yeah, I think that it's probably a combination of both. I've heard some members of Congress express the belief that it's true that I think Americans would not mind footing the tab for something like this. But there's a difference of opinion as to whether or not that money should be coming through tax dollars, which, of course, all Americans would be providing, versus a corporate sponsorship that, while draws money from consumers, it also allows the corporations to attach themselves in some fashion to the Statue of Liberty, which is a public landmark belonging to everyone. I mean, for instance, Folgers in his campaign describes itself as, you know, the theme of this campaign is, you know, one American icon to another, meaning they're comparing themselves, Folgers coffee, to the Statue of Liberty. I think that has not settled very well with certain members of Congress.
So what is happening now? What kind of investigations are underway, briefly?
Well, within the last couple of weeks, the Inspector General's Office of the Department of Interior, which oversees the National Park Service, has started an investigation into the Park Service's relationships with the foundation, and specifically looking at how the foundation has spent the private donations that's raised over the years on park projects. In addition to that, some congressmen yesterday asked the General Accounting Office, investigative arm of Congress, to also conduct an investigation. I should also mention that, you know, for all of the concerns that have been raised recently about this particular campaign, the foundation over the years has certainly done a number of, you know, very good projects for the monument. So most of the complaints that you're hearing now deal with the question of whether or not this campaign was managed properly and raises questions about why the Park Service didn't take it on itself and instead turn it over to the foundation.
Hmm. Well, Mike, thank you.
Thank you.
Mike McIntyre, reporter for the New York Times.
Last night, four alleged victims of former priest Paul Shanley reached a settlement in a civil suit. Shanley is one of the most notorious alleged sexual abusers in the Boston Archdiocese. But in the vast church sexual abuse scandal, former priest James Porter was one of the first convicted. In 1993, he was sentenced to serve 18 to 20 years in prison, found guilty of 41 counts of sexual abuse against 28 boys and girls, including two babysitters. Porter married after he was defrocked in 1974. Porter has now served his time. He was set to be released from prison in January, but the local district attorney is fighting to keep him locked up. Joining us on the line from the courthouse where testimony just ended is WBUR reporter Monica Brady-Meyerhoff. Monica, welcome.
Thank you.
Monica, what happened in court this morning? This was a probable cause hearing, right?
That's right, but it really is seeming more like a trial because the state is calling many witnesses over the course of the next several days. This morning we heard from two. They were sisters who say that during the 1980s, in separate incidents over a course of years, they were both molested by former Father James Porter while they were babysitting his children. They went into graphic details of the abuse, saying that he groped them, he pushed himself against them in a sexual way, and in one case, the babysitter was forced to undress and take a bath with Porter's children.
Mm-hmm. But Porter was to have served his time for the criminal charges against him as of January. The DEA is now seeking what's called a civil commitment for Porter. What is that all about?
Civil commitment is a civil law that says if the state believes a person is sexually dangerous and is likely to commit a sexual offense if they're released, that they should be civilly committed to Bridgewater State Hospital, which is essentially a mental institution slash prison in Massachusetts. What this means is it's different than a criminal case in that he cannot be tried again for the criminal charges because that would be double jeopardy, but he can be held in a civil commitment. Now, civil commitment has to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that James Porter will offend again, will sexually molest children if he's let out, because the standard is as high as a criminal case because it could take away his freedom rights. Civil commitment is a law that about 16 different states have, and it's been successful, prosecutors feel, in keeping sexually dangerous people off the streets even after they've served their criminal time.
What kind of sentence could he wind up with if he is civilly committed?
Well, the way civil commitment works is that you get a day to life. That means that you could be in for one day and then petition a judge to have another hearing and be released the next. But the reality is that doesn't happen. You are able to get a rehearing on your charges every year, but backlog is such that it can take 4 years to be heard by a judge or a jury and have your case reviewed. Now, critics say the whole problem with this law is that you can't predict what someone will do in the future, and these civil commitment trials aren't looking to commit him for anything he's done in the past. They're trying to look at Porter and say, what might he do in the future? Psychologists and psychiatrists say that while it is possible, and scientists are getting better at predicting what groups of people can do, it's really impossible to predict what an individual may do in the future.
The defense will probably be pointing out James Porter's age as well.
That's right. Age will be a factor. Porter is 69 years old right now, and a lot of the research studies show that sexual offenders at the age of 70 drop to less than 1% likely to reoffend, that they just don't have the same sexual impulses as they get older.
And for the time being, James Porter remains in the Bridgewater treatment facility where he could end up after this jury trial for a very long time.
That's right. And the treatment facility, while called a treatment facility, looks more like a prison. I've been there myself. It would be as if he were back in prison for possibly the rest of his life.
WBUR reporter Monica Brady-Meyerov joined us on the line from Taunton, Massachusetts. Monica, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Just ahead, how the business-friendly Bush administration unraveled 30 years of clean air legislation, according to one observer.
And later, the voice of Lisa Simpson takes to the stage.
There's more coming up, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's here and now.
When President Bush unveiled his Clear Skies Initiative in 2002, he said his plan would set tough new standards to dramatically reduce sulfur dioxide, nitrogen oxides, and mercury in the environment. But a new review of Bush's air emissions policies in yesterday's New York Times Magazine concludes quite the opposite. In fact, according to author Bruce Barcott, the Bush initiative will allow 50% more sulfur dioxide, 40% more nitrogen oxides, and three times as much mercury as the 30-year-old Clean Air Act. And further, says Barcott, the Bush plan was calculated to dismantle 30 years of a clean air policy that was on the verge of actually cleaning the air. Bruce Barcott is an associate editor at Outside Magazine. He joins us now. And, Bruce, these are strong accusations. They hinge on something called New Source Review. That required old polluting plants to install pollution-controlling devices if they made upgrades. Industry has said that this was too expensive and too vague to implement.
Yeah, that was their long-standing claim about New Source Review. But a couple things to consider. They say that pollution filters are expensive. The year that the EPA sued these companies over their violations of the Clean Air Act, one of the largest companies that was sued, posted a profit of $1.3 billion. And a lot of the fines that are ultimately negotiated in these cases are relatively small. I mean, one company, Tampa Electric, walked away paying a fine equivalent to 2% of their annual profit that year.
President Bush's initiative had suggested a cap-and-trade system that would allow power plants that reduce their emission below the allowable standard to sell their extra pollution allowance to companies that hadn't met the standard. Mm-hmm. Why wasn't that a good tactic?
The problem with the president's cap-and-trade program is that it sets standards for lower emissions that would be met by about the year 2015. In the year 2001, the Bush administration had a lot of those reductions already in hand. The EPA was negotiating with a lot of these power companies over new source review, and it was on the verge of reducing the sulfur dioxide and a lot of other emissions by 50%. Instead of meeting those goals by the year 2001, the Bush administration now says, well, we'll meet them by 2015.
A top EPA official went on ABC TV and said, in fact, we have better standards already than the ones that are being suggested by the president. There was a sense that the industry saw the Bush administration coming into office as sort of letting them off the hook.
The top officials in the EPA's enforcement department were negotiating with a lot of these power companies. One of the officials I talked to said the day that Bush was inaugurated, they were working through the inauguration trying to settle a lot of these new source review lawsuits because they knew what was coming, and so did the power companies. One top EPA official I talked to said, look, we were 80% done with these companies, and they were agreeing to take all that sulfur dioxide out of the air. But as soon as the Bush administration came in, essentially they sent loud and clear signals to the power companies that, hold on, don't negotiate, change is coming.
Hmm. Well, as you document, many EPA officials, Democrat and Republican, some there for decades, have quit. Some say in disgust with what they see as the trashing of 30 years of their work. But what happens now?
Now, actually, the new source review rules are on hold because New York State Attorney General Elliot Spitzer and I think about 14 or 15 others have sued the administration over the rules. They've said, basically, look, you can't just scuttle an entire act of Congress, a part of the Clean Air Act, through a new rule interpretation.
What do you say, though, to the continued industry argument that the Bush administration rules are better for jobs, better for energy output, which is a huge concern for people right now, and ultimately better for the economy?
Basically, the rest of us pay for this. The rest of us pay for this with our health insurance. The rest of us pay for this with our hospital bills. I mean, there are a number of medical studies that are done that say that pollution from coal-fired power plants essentially results in 30,000 premature deaths every year.
So where does President Bush's Clear Skies Initiative stand now?
The Clear Skies Initiative is stalled and has very, very little chance of passing. But last December, Mike Leavitt, the new EPA administrator, announced essentially a new set of rules that would, in essence, implement a lot of the programs in Clear Skies. Clear Skies, in a sense, is going through. It's just not going through Congress.
Bruce Barcott is contributing editor at Outside Magazine and the author of this week's New York Times Magazine cover story, Up in Smoke. Bruce, thank you.
Thank you.
And for more information, go to our website, here-now.org.
It was 10 years ago today that Kurt Cobain, the leader of the influential rock band Nirvana, committed suicide. Cobain killed himself with a shotgun, an event that stunned Nirvana fans, including Alex Ashlock. He's a producer here at WBUR, and he has these thoughts.
I don't really know why Kurt Cobain killed himself, but when you struggle with your own depression, you understand a little bit at least how a person can feel that desperate. I can't pull the trigger, but he did. After a struggle with the suffocating trappings of global rock star success, his drug addiction and health problems, he turned himself into a ghost. And like they always are in hindsight, I guess, the suicide signs were obvious. Like Tom Sawyer, Cobain even staged his own funeral, Nirvana Unplugged. The candles, the lilies, the songs about death. People who were there that night said it was like being in church. Forget that spokesman of a generation junk. Kurt Cobain wasn't a hero or a role model. But he did leave something meaningful behind, and I'm again drawn to his music in a new way. My 14-year-old son is listening to Nirvana now and asking me questions about Kurt Cobain. He's down in the basement with his bass guitar trying to learn Nirvana songs. We'll probably be watching the tributes tonight on MTV together. There was a scene in one of the last stories I read about Kurt Cobain. It was 3 or 4 a.m. in Seattle. The author of the story and Cobain were just driving around in the suburbs. Cobain asked to be dropped off. He said goodbye, and he just disappeared. One of the biggest rock stars in the world, left alone and anonymous. If I could meet him in my own often sleepless world, I would thank him for the songs and thank him for giving me a connection to my son. It makes it easier for me not to say goodbye like he did.
WBUR producer Alex Ashlock. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
It's Here and Now.
President Bush this morning said he's looking forward to the testimony this Thursday of his national security adviser, Condoleezza Rice, before the 9/11 Commission. Members of the commission were all over television talk shows Sunday, urging the White House not to delay the commission's final report this summer after vetting it for security leaks. Also, one of the commission's chairs suggested the report could conclude the 9/11 attacks were preventable. Joining us on the line to talk about it all are Rich Lowry, editor of the conservative magazine, The National Review. Hello, Rich.
Hi, thanks for having me.
And David Korn, Washington editor of The Nation magazine. Hi, David.
Good to be with you.
David, let's start with you, and I'd like to ask you both, what's the greatest pitfall for Condoleezza Rice in her testimony Thursday?
I think the commission should avoid the whole back and forth with her and Richard Clark over whether the administration took the threat of al-Qaeda urgently and seriously. The president himself told Bob Woodward he didn't see it with any urgency. The 9/11 commission has already produced interim reports showing that people at the Pentagon working on counterterrorism thought that Rumsfeld and his team were essentially uninterested. And so and there are other examples, too. So I don't think they should get bogged down in that. What I think they should bore in on is the August 6th presidential daily briefing. In May 2002, CBS News broke the story that Bush on that day had received a briefing that mentioned al-Qaeda and hijacking, and Condoleezza Rice immediately came out and said it was just an analytic report, a historical paper, didn't really have anything important in it. Yet, the 9/11 final report put out by the House and Senate Intelligence Committees notes that it's likely that the report contained very, very dire warnings that al-Qaeda had a support structure in the United States, that that bin Laden was interested in mounting attacks here using explosives and was interested in doing hijacking here, much different than what Condoleezza Rice told the American public. And the issue is that indeed the case? And the other issue is, how did she and the president respond to that warning and other warnings in the summer of 2001, particularly in light of the fact that after 9/11, Bush told Bob Woodward that he didn't see an urgent threat.
So, Rich Lowry, do you see a major problem in that briefing that Condoleezza Rice gave to the president at his ranch in Crawford, Texas on August 6th? Is that the greatest pitfall for her?
Well, I think the greatest pitfall is Condi and the White House kind of getting backed into an unsustainable position, which is that, you know, they were on to al-Qaeda with the kind of urgency that they had after September 11th, which was demonstrably untrue. No one treated this, or very few people, with the kind of urgency it needed prior to 9-1-1, not Republicans, not Democrats, not Congress, not the media. And the fact is that a lot of the attention was on attacks overseas. There may have been warnings of attacks here at home, but the majority of it was overseas. And it's very easy, kind of afterwards, to pick out the things that you should have paid attention to particularly.
Rich, how honest should she be to explain warnings she might have missed insofar as saying, I'm a trained Sovietologist, I'm a Europeanist, she has called herself that, with frankly little expertise in the Islamic world and counterterrorism?
Well, I don't think she needs to pretend to be Bernard Lewis, the great scholar on the Islamic world.
Mm-hmm.
And I think she can just tell the truth about what was happening in the administration, which is that this issue was being worked at the deputies' level. They were working on a strategy that would represent a departure, although perhaps not a radical enough one, from the Clinton approach. And the fact is that that was worked out with relative swiftness by the administration, and it was just the fact that those attacks happened on September 11th that makes it seem so terribly tardy. But let's be honest here. What people are criticizing the Bush administration for is continuing the Clinton policy too long. And I agree, they should have changed it more quickly. But even Clark himself has said, with regard to the ideas he had for Afghan policy, that if they had been implemented in January 2001, it wouldn't have made a difference and it wouldn't have prevented the attacks.
But there are a couple of things here. The interim reports of the 9/11 Commission say that at least in one key area, the Bush people didn't continue the Clinton policy. They noted that Clinton increasingly was putting pressure on the Saudi government to work with Washington to do something about bin Laden and al-Qaeda. They didn't get the cooperation they wanted out of the Saudis, but nevertheless, they were trying. When the Bush people came in, they dropped that initiative and did nothing on that front and just let it sit for 9 months. So it's not quite true that they, you know, did everything that the Clinton folks were doing beforehand. And, you know, and Richard Clark has made the case that on matters like the USS Cole, this is another key issue, I think, for Condi Rice, that it really wasn't until the end of 2000, beginning of 2001, when the Clinton administration was basically packing its bags, that the CIA was able to link the USS Cole bombing, which happened in October 2000, to bin Laden. And, you know, an issue for her is, yeah, you were doing a policy review that took 8 months. Why were there no meetings, the issue of USS Cole even discussed all that time? So, I mean, listen, they made mistakes. Clinton folks made some mistakes. The best thing that the White House could have done would have been to own up to these mistakes, but they didn't do that. And I think they're going to get caught and hoisted on the petard of their own rhetoric and their own, you know, CYA statements that they made after 9/11 about what they did and did not do before 9/11.
On the other hand, David Corn, you brought it up right away. How much is the importance of this testimony neutralized if the testimony becomes he said, she said?
Well, that is, I think, what the White House intent is, to make this look like a partisan back and forth mud wrestle, get the public to turn off. Democrats say this, Republicans say that. I mean, that's why they attacked Richard Clark and called his testimony partisan, because the public does turn off to that.
Rich Lowry, how much does the White House have riding on all this? We've seen the polls in the wake of the previous hearings. Bush wasn't hurt by it. He may have been helped by the testimony then.
Yeah, this I don't think it's going to hurt Bush one way or the other, because I think people have already made essentially the conclusion that David fears they're going to make, which is that this is about partisan politics. And the fact is, inquisitorial hearings like this never have the damaging effect on an administration that all of us in Washington and the media think they're going to. Iran-Contra didn't. The Whitewater hearings didn't. And this won't. And the reason is because Richard Clark may not have been a partisan when he was in government, but has made himself into a partisan hatchet man. I mean, to say that Bill Clinton was totally on the ball and then Bush totally dropped the ball by continuing the Clinton policy in its essential aspects makes no sense unless you're a partisan hatchet man. And I don't know where David gets the idea that the Bush administration didn't discuss the coal, which I believe is what he said. The idea that the Bushies had, maybe this was flawed, was that the proper response to the coal would be to craft a much more aggressive strategy to roll back and eliminate al-Qaeda rather than just striking haphazardly at a few terrorist training camps.
Commission member and former Senator Bob Kerry said 4 hours with Condoleezza Rice won't be nearly enough. Several minutes with you two hasn't been nearly enough either. I want to thank both of you very much. Rich Lowry, editor of the National Review. Rich, thanks a lot.
Thanks for having me.
And David Korn, Washington editor of The Nation magazine. Thanks, David.
My pleasure.
Still to come, actress Yardley Smith is more than the character Lisa Simpson. She's herself in a new one-woman show.
You're listening to Here and Now. The IRS has asked for $12 million to hire 80 new financial investigators who specialize in tracking terrorist finances. But the White House has turned the request down. Is this an example of the government not devoting adequate resources to the war on terror? Jody Myers led the White House's office that tracks down money used by groups like al-Qaeda and Hamas. He left that post in January, and we welcome Mr. Myers.
Thank you for having me.
Mr. Myers, the administration would save only $12 million, which is, of course, a quintillionth of the overall federal budget, by not allowing the IRS to have the 50% more criminal investigators of terror finances that it wants. Why quibble over $12 million?
Well, that's a good question. I actually find this story a little bit troubling. The overall effort on terrorist financing is relatively low cost. It does require some high-tech computers, but mainly it requires good old-fashioned hard work by specialized investigators.
You find it troubling. Why?
Well, I find it troubling because in my experience in the government, about almost 12 years at Treasury, IRS criminal investigators are the best financial investigators the government has. They tend to be very selfless. They support task forces. And they've been suffering a lot of attrition recently, both driven by demographics. A lot of their agents are retiring, but also by competition. They are recognized in the private sector as for their skills, and they're recruited heavily into the private sector where they can make more money. I think they do generally need to be trying to backfill for this lost capacity. And while I recognize they're pulled in a number of different directions, tax evasion, drug money laundering, following Saddam's money, et cetera, I don't think there's anything more important than doing the terrorist financing cases.
What is the White House's public argument for why it's decided not to provide the IRS the 80 more criminal investigators it wanted?
The White House pointed to an increase at Treasury, but that's kind of comparing apples and oranges. Those resources are going to increase resources at FinCEN, which is the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, and OFAC, which administers sanctions. Those are analytical and intelligence resources that are really not comparable to the IRS criminal investigators.
Right. A 16% increase in Treasury is what is being put out there.
Those resources are necessary also. I'm not saying they aren't.
Mr. Myers, in terms of the testimony of Richard Clark, the former counterterrorism chief, who has accused the administration of not focusing enough on terror efforts, certainly before 9/11 and to a degree even after 9/11, how does that testimony play into the politics swirling around this sort of thing?
Well, it clearly it does play into the politics. I'm actually glad that you're focusing on this issue because this is an area that the government has come relatively late to, and quite honestly, the government doesn't really even have a clear sense of the level of resources it has devoted across all the agencies to combating terrorist financing. I think that's should be a very high priority so that there can be a reasoned debate about where those resources can most effectively be put.
Jody Myers led the White House office that tries to track down money used by groups like al-Qaeda. Mr. Myers, thanks very much.
Thank you for having me.
Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now.
I'm Bill Delaney.
I'm Robin Young.
It's Here and Now.
I got a bratty brother. He bugs me every day. And this morning my own mother, she gave my last cupcake away.
For the past 18 years, actress Yardley Smith has given 8-year-old Lisa Simpson her voice. Simpsons fans are holding their breath. Yardley and the rest of the cast are in a pay dispute with the show's producers. More on that in a moment. In the meantime, Yardley has been starring in her own off-Broadway show called, coincidentally, More. And Yardley Smith joins us on the line from Carnegie Hall Studios in New York. Hi.
Hi, Robin. How are you?
I'm fine. I'm sorry. When you say hello to people, do they? I mean, I just had a reaction because it's just so great to hear your voice. Do people tell you that?
Yeah, they do, and they recognize me in line at the supermarket, and they recognize me over the telephone when I'm making an airplane reservation. It's pretty unmistakable, because to do Lisa Simpson, it's just right up here, so it's not all that different.
Oh, my goodness. Do you mind asking how old you are?
39.
And she's 8.
And she's 8.
And she's the one in a state of arrested development.
Yes, although, wiser than so many other 39-year-olds I know. She manages to evolve, even though every time she has a birthday, she turns 8, so she's 8, and then she turns 8. And then, can't really explain that.
And then, woohoo, she turns 8 again. What did you have to, in addition to having just the texture of the voice that you have, what do you do to be an 8-year-old?
I think a lot of it's in that drawing of Lisa Simpson that kicks the character in a nanosecond, and mm-hmm. I see her. And see the words on the page, and it's quite automatic.
Well, yeah, because how many other 8-year-olds are wearing a string of pearls, a strapless sort of gown of some sort?
I know, a strapless red dress. It's so funny, and it's kind of scandalous, don't you think?
Yeah, I do.
Bearing your shoulders in the third grade.
What do you think? What does this say about her, that she wears a strand of pearls and a strapless dress?
Well, the real story about it, I believe, is that it's an homage to the Flintstones, and that's why Marge also wears a strapless gown and pearls, because Matt Groening was a huge Flintstones fan.
Do you like her?
Oh, I love her, really. Honestly, I mean, in spite of my rapacious ambition and my desire to have won 2 Academy Awards by the time I was 21, if I have to be remembered for one character for the length of my career, I would be pleased and proud if it was Lisa Simpson.
Because
she really is a great little... I mean, she's great. Yeah. She's got so much soul. She is, in many ways... more complex and fleshed out than many live-action characters.
Mustard fleshed out, we should say.
Yes, yes, mustard fleshed out indeed.
Well, and now you mentioned that, you know, you had these other desires, which brings us to More, the name of your Broadway play. More what? Would seem to have so much.
I do, and yet I don't understand why people think that should be enough or why I should settle. I do. I mean, and it is not out of a lack of gratitude that I... all these years never really felt all that successful. It was just truly that I had set up a separate set of rules for myself about what my success would look like. And I literally had a to-do list when I was in my 20s. And
What was on the list?
Lose weight, get married, get rich, get famous, be happy, and win an Academy Award by the time I was 20 and another by the time I was 21.
Mm-hmm.
And... it didn't really allow for the ebb and flow of life, which is, of course, natural. So I was sort of the salmon constantly swimming upstream, but I never reached my destination is the way I felt.
Right.
I stopped getting asked to do a lot of work in front of the camera in the last decade, and I finally got tired of complaining about it, so I wrote a show for myself.
So that's what the show is about, sort of, I want more.
It is about, and I think it's a show, it's actually extremely funny. It's about all of the crazy and sometimes obsessive things you do to cope with that deficit that you may feel inside of you. It's a show for people who have ever felt like, I am what I do, and then if you don't get to do it as much as you would like, then you will have a huge identity crisis.
It's sort of like, it's a setup. I mean, you can't win.
Exactly.
Right.
It is that. And I do, it seems to be a rather universal message, I have to say. People tell me afterwards what they do in order to cope with that same feeling they have inside.
Yeah. Well, you know, and I'm going to just only mention this briefly, but it just screams out to be mentioned because the name of your play is Moore. And we understand that the Simpsons characters, the voices of the Simpsons characters, are now striking for more pay. I mean,
sure.
It sort of begs a question. Would you really walk away from the Simpsons over a pay increase?
It certainly hasn't come to that yet, so it's not a decision I care to consider in any way, shape, or form. You know, I think it's typical for studio and actors to disagree on a pay raise, and, you know, they kind of go at each other, and then I'm optimistic that it will be resolved.
And I just can't imagine. I mean, I think Lisa's irreplaceable, frankly.
I agree.
I'm sure you would. Well, back to Moore, the play, not Moore, the pay controversy. Whatever possessed you to do a one-woman show? Have you been thinking about this?
No, not at all. Never wanted to do it. Never wanted to write a show for myself. Really hoped that I would get another on-camera television show or perhaps a movie that would save me from having to do a show that I wrote about myself for myself. But that said, I actually am quite pleased with the way it turned out, and I did want to create a job for myself. The Simpsons only takes a couple of days a week, so I was feeling like I wanted to be more creatively active and be on stage again as an actor, so I thought you better put up or shut up. So that's what I did.
Well, and I can see how you might be driven to it. Looking back over, I wasn't aware that you were cut from one of the first movies you were in, The She-Devil.
Yep.
A film with Emo Phillips was never released. You were fired from the film Say Anything and replaced by the producer's daughter. It's almost like you have to write your own show.
You kind of do.
You know, nobody sees you on The Simpsons, so...
It's true, and you know, in this business, certainly few people are going to do you any favors, and nowadays it's very in vogue to have your fingers in all the different pies.
What has doing this show done for you?
I think it's, for one thing, I feel in fantastic form as an actor these days, which is lovely, because it's been the hardest work I've ever done, without question. And the most harrowing, and has required the most discipline I've ever had to exercise, because I'm the only one up there.
Yeah.
And
it's
I
you.
I pretty much talk, you know?
Yeah.
And it is me, and it is my life.
Well, I know that this is a dangerous thing to do, but I'm going to do it anyway. Is it possible for us to hear from Lisa before you leave, or does Lisa live in
you?
You
know,
or?
She does live in me. I can tell you that I can read off the Kleenex box.
Sure.
Because
you need script.
I'm not very good at improvising. Kleenex 2-ply tissues. Our signal feature lets you know when you need a new box.
Something Lisa
gripping,
would
isn't it?
Yes. Something Lisa would never say ever.
No, because you know she's so not into commerce that way. It's all about the art. She would tell you about the design on the Kleenex box. It's a lovely sort of Italian marbleized paper motif.
What would she say to you about Moore, do you think?
Oh, I think she would be really proud. I think she would say, I'm proud to be so closely associated with somebody who had the courage to go the distance. I think she would remind me that I accomplished what I set out to do, which was create a job for myself. I wrote a play. I said it the way I wanted to say it. And I made people laugh, and they came to see it.
Yep.
What's better than that?
Yeah. Thank you so much.
Thank you. That was a pleasure.
Yardley Smith is now starring in her one-woman show, Moore, on Off-Broadway. For more information, check out our website, here-now.org.
Yeah.
Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston.
I'm Robin Young.
I'm Bill Delaney.
Get into your radio.
Join us again, Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.